Welcome to Clareton Conversation. My name is Katie Asbester, and our guest today is Declan Hill. Declan is a journalist, academic, and consultant. He is one of the world's foremost experts on match fixing and corruption in international sports. In 2008, Hill obtained his doctorate in sociology from the University of Oxford, and currently he's a senior research fellow in anti-corruption in sports at University of Würzburg and a professor at University of New Haven. His book, The Fix, Organized Crime and Soccer, has been translated into 21 languages. Declan Hill was the first person to show the new danger to international sport posed by the globalization of the gambling market and match fixing at the highest levels of professional football, including the Champions League and FIFA World Cup tournaments. Welcome to Clareton Conversation, Declan.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
You've managed to make a career out of football. That's every boy's dream. Is this what you thought you would be doing with your life, is going to football games? And
Look, I love sport. It's given me some of the best moments of my life. It's given me some of my best friends and contacts and really great joy. I've never been a particularly good athlete. I've certainly never been at a professional level. I've won lots of little amateur stuff, but really far more than a cupboard full of medals and trophies and cups. It's really given me great and wonderful memories, and I do love sport, and I love football in particular. So I'm happy and proud to do my work and try to keep corruption out of international sport.
Do you think it was this passion you've got for playing the game that has led you to kind of relentlessly pursue and uncover corruption? Or did you stumble into it?
No, I think it is the most pressing existential problem for international sport right now. The tsunami of corruption that is hitting international tennis, that's hitting international football. You know, yesterday.
Can you give me an idea of some numbers here, Declan? Like, what kind of numbers are we talking about?
Well, look, since I first identified the problem in 2005 in a public speech in Copenhagen, where I warned about a tsunami of international match fixing coming to world of sport, we have seen well over 80 different countries being affected by this onslaught of corruption. You have whole elephant's graveyard in Asia of sports that have been destroyed. The Malaysian and Singapore Football League in the early 90s had millions of people in attendance over a total season. Now you're lucky to break 10,000. It's just killed by this corruption.
Because people know the results are fixed.
People just know. They can't believe it. You know, the credibility has gone. So if I'm going to spend my professional life doing work in corruption against organized crime, which is essentially what my career is about, doing this research, uncovering these kind of things, I cannot think of a better way of spending it than fighting to keep sport as clean as possible.
There's a part in one of your book, The Fix, which I've read and I highly recommend. It's a fantastic journey, both personally for you and also leading us into a discovery of the extent and depth of football corruption. But you tell this fantastic story about rowing in Britain, in England, and how it was the premier sport. And it fell from favor because of being fixed, and people they couldn't be bothered to watch it any longer.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, in between 1850s and the early 1900s, professional rowing was the greatest sport in the Western world. Most of the great Brazilian football teams, many of the Canadian football, as in Canadian form of football, New York Harbor, up and down the Thames, obviously, was packed with professional rowers. And the fixing got so bad that it just killed off rowing. And I think that is essentially what's happening to some international sports now, certainly to many sports in Asia. They've been killed off. The International Olympics are now, for the demographic under 25, a kind of the thing that, you know, dad and mom watch, but we're into e-sports. And part of that reason is just that the thoroughly sullied reputation, and deservedly so, reputation of many of these international institutions and much of the corruption. The way I made a transition from standard investigative journalism into investigative journalism about corruption in sport was that I was actually doing a massive documentary for American PBS Frontline and the Canadian television on the connections between key Russian mafia godfathers and stars in what's called the National Hockey League, the NHL. And one of the senators, the U.S. Senate investigators, had said, you know, Mr. Hill, almost every single Russian hockey player in the NHL is paying some form of protection to some mafia godfather. But the evidence that we were able to uncover showed clear business relationships between key members of the Russian organized crime and really prominent stars. I mean, one of the guys was, his name was on the paper, his name was on corporate documents for the chosen financial vehicle, you know, the company set up by the Russian mafia that the FBI identified as was the chief money laundering institution. So they're pumping through tens of millions of dollars in this company, and it was officially owned by one of the prominent National Hockey League players. So as part of the investigation, myself and the TV crew, we went to Moscow and we did an interview with one of the guys who'd been linked, a man who was identified by the U.S. Congress and the FBI as, quote, the head of the Russian mafia. And we did an interview. Lyndon McIntyre was a very famous Canadian journalist, had been to Georgia, the country of this fellow. And so he invited us out for dinner after the interview. So I remember going back to the hotel, and the camera crew said, look, we get paid to come to Russia and film interviews. We don't get paid to go for dinner with the head of the Russian mafia. And the other producer looked at them and said, look, I understand completely, and we're journalists. And if the head of the Russian mafia invites us out to dinner, we'd better go. So myself and Lyndon and the producer went, and it was an eerie scene. We drove up to this squalid little restaurant in the outskirts of Moscow. It was middle of February, and we walked into the front room, and it was full of construction workers from Newcastle, drinking pints and pints after pints. We had no idea what they were doing there. And I went back out and said, you know, is this the place, the driver? And he was like, yes, absolutely certain. So we're standing there in this shabby-looking place. It's full of, Geordie construction workers. And at that moment, the head of the Russian mob pulls up in an armored-plated 4x4 and parks about 18 inches from the front door. And the bodyguards jump in, they run in, and they take us down this tiny little alleyway, no more than 2.5-3 feet. And there's bodyguards in Gucci suits at either end, and we walk into a back room, which is like a velour, green velour paradise with gold chandeliers. Not my style, but if you're that way inclined, it was great. Fantastic food. It was something like a 15-course Georgian meal. Anyway, when you're having dinner with the head of the Russian mob, you're always a bit stuck for conversation. And so,
how was your day, dear? Best day at work?
You can't really, So I said, I guess you like hockey, do you? And very politely, I mean, the whole dinner was conducted with real courtesy and politeness. He said, I like hockey, and I like, the particular star that we were interviewing him about. But I really love football. And he started telling us the story about how he was in the VVIP box, that's very, very important person box, at the FIFA World Cup final with Al Gore and Pelé and Hillary Clinton. But he wasn't just in the box. He was in the front row, two away from the FIFA president. I had a couple of thoughts going through my mind as I was listening to this story. The first one was, I really hope I get out of this restaurant alive.
Yes.
And then the second one was, if I do, I want to figure out what this man was doing at the very symbolic heart of international football. Effectively, what that is, it's like being on the balcony. If you're a Catholic, it's like being on a balcony with the Pope on Easter Sunday in the Vatican. I mean, it doesn't get, in terms of symbolism, it doesn't get any higher. Anyway,
did you figure that one out, Declan?
I mean, well, that's what I spent, my career. I was very fortunate to get a scholarship to go to the University of Oxford soon after that and study in a fantastic department full of really interesting people, very non-academic, very interesting, engaged people. One woman studies the, quote, informal governance of the IRA in no-go areas in Derry and Belfast. And what happens with the IRA there is that they shoot kids in the knee if they're found stealing cars or, mm-hmm. or dealing with drugs. And she went and interviewed, and she's a Protestant, so there's tremendous risks there, but she went and interviewed people who, after their knees had been blown off, continued to steal cars or sell drugs illicitly on those streets, to really focus on why extreme risk takers, what were they doing? Was it to put food on the table? Was it, you know, were they, why would they be so crazy?
And what was her conclusion? Because that's a very good question.
Let me skip over that. I'm sure when you have her on, she'll be able to describe it much better than I can.
Don't leave me hanging here.
a colleague at Oxford was a guy, Peter Hill, who was an expert and is an expert in the Yakuza, the Japanese mafia. He gained tremendous access to the Yamaguchi-gama, which is the predominant Yakuza clan, because he's an expert in karate. And so he was doing karate and martial arts in Japan. He was a former Scottish military chap. I think it was the Scottish Paras. And they brought him in, and he wrote a stunning book on the Japanese mafia. And we were all acolytes of a guy, Diego Gambetta, who wrote really the stunning academic piece on the Sicilian mafia back in the early 90s, explaining and breaking down and kind of unpacking how the Sicilian mafia works. As part of his field work, he'd received a number of death threats. So it was a fascinating place to be. Many other people like that, we would sit and discuss and talk about the dangers of field work and how we worked and what we were doing. And so it was just stunning. And because of my interest from the Russian mafia, I got more and more into corruption and studying corruption in sport.
So can we just wrap one thing up, though? You left me hanging in this dinner.
Yes.
In the back of a restaurant. You know, it sounds like something straight out of a movie.
Well,
awkward conversation with somebody who plans murders. And you're talking about sports. I mean, it's extraordinary. I suppose at one level, the thing I find so extraordinary about it is how sports, like music, bonds people across enormous divides, which is one of the great strengths of sports that I think is undervalued. And the second thing is, how did that end? How did that wrap up? Did you, at the end of the dinner, you all shook each other's hand and said, "That was a lovely dinner, thank you very much," and you went home?
Yes, pretty much. And I would say, in his defense, that the precautions that he took, driving up with his armor-plated 4x4, 18 inches from the front door, were probably pretty sensible, because the office overlooking the Kremlin, where we had conducted the interview, was blown up in a bombing attack about 6 weeks later. So that was the time in the late 90s, early 2000s, of real mafia warfare. And warfare is not an inaccurate description. There were thousands of people killed. To return to your question about sports, his mafia organization, the 21st Century Association, had the bad luck of having its first two chiefs killed in mafia-style hits. The connection between that and sport was that they had deliberately, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, gone and recruited ex-Olympic boxers, wrestlers, combat sports, and filled the ranks of their organized crime army with those sportsmen, and did it very, very clearly. In fact, one of the guys who was eventually killed ran for the Duma, the parliament, under the party, the sportsman's party. There's no doubt that sport is the religion of our time. I was doing work on a football team in the slums of Kenya in Nairobi, and I use that word slums because that is the same term that the people who live there use.
Yes. And I've seen pictures.
And the redemptive power of sport now is extraordinary. I mean, it does sound a bit flaky to say that, but if you look at what religion does, it gives you a collective sense of identity. People are bonded together over a common narrative, their sense of identity, the sense of decoration, of dressing up, of you know, many times singing together. You look at the largest building in medieval France or medieval Europe was the cathedrals and the churches. Now it's the Stuart Stadium. So it's
That's
not...
That's a good point. I hadn't thought about it that way. There's also, I have to add, in religion, a strong ethos. It may be honored in the breach, but it is explicit and evoked. And I would say that that is also true in sports. Sportsmanship. You know, you win, it's a fair shot, you win. You lose. You know, no hard feelings, you've lost. You know, there's a very clear kind of ethic that underlines sports. And I wonder if one of the things that makes sports corruption so appalling is the fact that it violates that almost religious belief.
I want to make it clear, Katie, that I'm not in any way suggesting that it's equivalent. I'm just saying sport as a religion of our time, you know, I'm not being glib, I'm not being facile here, and for goodness sake, please, listeners, I'm not suggesting that it's a moral or spiritual equivalent. But I do think it bears comparison with a medieval church, because just as the Catholic Church, by the time the 1500s were coming round, was replete with selling of relics and indulgence falsification, all the things that eventually broke and caused a schism in the church. And you had endemic corruption in the church in the Middle Ages. So you have endemic corruption in international sport. And the same things go on. That sense of a moral, ethical facade is very useful for the most corrupt people in the world to use. So
that's a fantastic analogy, Declan. We don't want to overstretch the point. I mean, we certainly don't want to offend anybody, and that's certainly not the intention. But it is, I can certainly see the value of that comparison. It's a very useful comparison.
In terms of organized crime, let's be really clear about something, because, you know, as our listeners are hearing this, they may be thinking, oh, well, this might be a bit embellished, or, you know, organized crime. Look, when finally the U.S. Internal Revenue Service and the U.S. Department of Justice brought the FIFA, the dozens of senior executives of FIFA, essentially the Vatican of international soccer, international football, the guys based in Zurich who organize like a series of cardinals and bishops and national associations. Again, this is not in any way to compare it with the Catholic Church in terms of morality or things, but the structure is very, very similar. The top 41 executives and their marketing people were arrested by U.S. Department of Justice. To this date, over 25 have either pled guilty or been convicted. And the court that tried them under what's called the RICO statute. That's the racketeering and corrupt organization statute specifically brought in to deal with organized crime and mafia. And so when I'm talking about FIFA being an organized crime group, it's not Declan Hill, investigative journalist, author of a number of best-selling books, that's saying that. It's the U.S. Department of Justice, and it's more importantly, it's a judge sitting in the Southern District of New York who said intense experience with the Russian mafia and Chinese triads and the five families of New York, cracking through hundreds of pages of documents on FIFA's operation and going, you know what, this isn't organized crime organization. This is very much like the mafia. And to add to the strength of that argument, it's not just the judge, the defense lawyers defending some of these people who are eventually convicted of racketeering and almost every imaginable type of fraud said, yes, it's the mafia organization. Yes, it's very equivalent to an organized crime thing. It's just that our clients are innocent. They're not part of the group that ran it.
You know, that's quite a distinction, you know. They're just best friends and buddies, but yes, absolutely, it's organized crime to start. Yeah, I don't know. That's not a hugely persuasive defense, is it?
It is absolutely stunning. I mean, for people who haven't been following the FIFA trial, there was one particular character out of Cayman Islands who took money that had been sent to him to help victims of the Haitian earthquake. And the Cayman local soccer, the youth soccer, that is for kids under the ages of 16, help them organize their league, help them with uniforms. And he spent $25,000 of that in one night in a strip club in Atlanta, Georgia.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a short break to hear from our sponsor and come right back to hear more about Declan Hill, the kid from Canada who grew up to battle corruption in organized sports.
Everything written should be read. but it can be confusing knowing how to go about it. Clapham Publishing Services is here to help. www.claphampublishing.com for all your publishing needs.
Welcome back to Claret and Conversation. Our guest today is Declan Hill, a journalist who exposes the seamy underbelly of corruption in sports. And we're hearing quite extraordinary stories about how much sport is, you know, organized crime is involved with sports on almost, it sounds like almost a global scale. And what I'm kind of interested in, Declan, if we could just take a step back from that and try to understand how you emerged into this. You grew up in Ottawa in Canada?
I'm like many of our listeners, I divided my time between the UK and Canada. My father was born in India of Irish and English parentage. My mom is a pure New England Yankee. So again, like many of our listeners, I'm a right old mongrel.
I was going to say you're a mutt.
with all kinds of different influences and on my background.
Yeah, it's a... But do you feel Canadian or British?
I think at some point you have to decide which side of the Atlantic you live on. And I am Canadian, even though I sound to many of our listeners as if I have a UK accent. I think you just, and it's not that I accept everything about Canada, the many things that I don't like, but I am Canadian.
Okay. Not that it really matters one way or another. It's not something that I think is of huge. I don't think it affects the quality of work you do. I'm just kind of curious about that kind of thing.
I think what you're actually trying to get around to is how and why I box with Justin Trudeau.
Oh, is that what I was asking you? Thanks for pointing that out, Declan. So Justin Trudeau is the Prime Minister of Canada.
As everyone in the world knows.
A good-looking young man. And he is actually right now as we speak, I'm not sure when this is going to go out, but as we speak, he's battling the next election, which is coming soon in October, isn't it? October 2019.
Yeah, and Justin Trudeau is in trouble now because essentially his party, the Liberals, were, some of them at least, and some pretty high-level guys, were running an organized crime scheme out of Montreal. And I'm happy to get into that in a second, but you've been begging since the program began, the podcast began.
And you just can't get me off the topic, can you?
To talk about Justin Trudeau and how he and I box together. And this is something
that
happens.
What year was this?
Something that happens to me constantly when I talk to women, because Justin was always perceived as a kind of womanizing playboy dilettante. And even though his father had cast an enormous shadow on the political and social world of Canada, his oldest son was just, he's this good-looking kid. You can't take him seriously.
And not very bright, too, is what people said.
And I think that Justin and his handlers understood this and understood that they were going to have to do something dramatic to change it. And what they decided to do was have a boxing match. He is considered a leftish politician, and they chose a right-wing politician. And the two of them were going to have a boxing match to raise money for cancer research. And by sheer chance, I happened to be a white-collar boxer at the same gym. And they asked me to, quote, fight a right-wing journalist. And I agreed because I thought it would just be two foofied guys like myself wearing our pocket protectors and our bow ties and would flail away, in a lighthearted fashion. Anyway, about 6 weeks before the fight, they came to me, these are the organizers, and said, oh, we couldn't find a journalist to fight you, but don't worry, Deck, the fight's still going ahead. We got the owner of a nightclub to fight you. And like an idiot, I should have said, I didn't sign up for that. I'm out of here.
Which nightclub owner?
A very muscular guy. He and I had sparred before, and I had a night of terror, as I'm sure many of our listeners have had in their personal lives, where you get yourself into a situation, you're just thinking, what was I doing? Why did I do that? Because not only was I, at that moment, probably going to lose a fight, because of the Justin effect, the fight night was going to be televised live on our equivalent of Fox or Sky News. And so the entire country was going to be watching. And there'd be about 1,000 people, many of them were journalists, many of them were my colleagues, and they would be delighted if I were beaten up in public. And so it was just...
That's performance pressure, isn't it? That's pure performance pressure.
Well, it's much worse than performance pressure, because your physical well-being when your boxing is right on the line. So at about 4:30 in the morning, I thought, I'm never going to be as strong as the guy that I'm fighting against, but I can outthink him. And at 7:30 in the morning, I was on the internet and on the phone. And by 11 that morning, I was on a plane to Cuba, and I trained with a Cuban national champion in boxing for about 2 weeks. And the Cubans just, you know, licked me into shape, probably two of the hardest and most intense weeks of my life. But anyway, I fought in the fight just before Justin was due to fight the right-wing politician. And everyone in Canada, with just a very few exceptions, thought that Justin was really going to get pasted. He was going to, you know, he had overreached himself. He was too stupid. He was a dilettante, and he was going to get beaten up. So I remember my match, my bout one, ended. I had the good fortune of winning. Saluted, you know, my very, you know, valiant and worthy opponent. We both stood and said, let's not forget on this night when everyone's here for Justin about cancer and about the people who aren't here. Let's raise a glass and raise some money for those to make sure that doesn't happen. And then I went off to my hotel room, you know, took off my gloves. By the time I got back down, Canadian political history had changed forever because Justin Trudeau hadn't just won the fight. He'd beaten the other fellow into a bloody pulp.
Yes, I saw it. Oh, actually, I was one of the, I mean, I wasn't in Canada at the time, but I was here, but I was following it.
Who didn't?
And it's on, it's on YouTube, it's all over. And I watched Justin Trudeau perform very well indeed.
He basically won the next election. And I remember he and I were at the back of the room, our arms were around each other's shoulders because we'd been the kind of skinny intellectual guys who everyone had expected to lose. And out of the 1,000 people in that room, I think 950 were of the right-wing party. And I'm using these words very lightly. But anyway, they were the supporters of that, at that time, the governing party. And they were trailing out with their heads hanging down. And there was two tables of the Liberals, which is Justin Trudeau's party. And his mum, his mother, who is famous international figure, celebrity figure, during a very tumultuous relationship and marriage to Justin's father. All kinds of, you know, I think at one point she dated Mick Jagger and Geraldo Rivera and all kinds of things. Anyway, she's now well into her 70s, but she was standing on the table, dancing, snapping her fingers. the small table of Liberals were cheering, and Justin and I had our arms around each other's shoulders in that satisfaction. Two men who accomplished a challenge, and I turned to him and said, this is where it all starts for you, isn't it? And he said, yes, it absolutely is. And it would be difficult to overstate the effect of that night on the Canadian psyche and the effect on the political events of Canada. Now it's 2019. Those things happened 7 years ago. And there has been a major scandal in Canadian politics which affects interference in our judicial process, potential organized crime, potential fraud, potential bribery involving some really, really, really serious accusations right up to the very top of the civil service and to the government itself. Anyone else except for Justin would be in serious, serious problems. I think, and most political observers think, that he'll be able to squeak it out just because of his charisma. And much of his charisma comes from that boxing night.
And again, we're talking about the power of sports here. You know, this is, again, a phenomenon which is underestimated at people's risk. I also think, an aside that's unrelated to our broader conversation, it also kind of belies the stereotype of Canadians being so incredibly nice and kind and sweet and gentle. I mean, we kind of watch people knock each other about in the name of cancer research, but it was also, I seem to remember, and that there was some bad feelings between the Justin Trudeau and whoever he was fighting against, a man whose name I can't remember. And, that was, people were kind of celebrating the fact that their blood was going to
Look, I think many people regard, there's always self-denial of your worst traits, and there's self-denial on a collective identity many English people, and I hope this isn't too offensive, but many English people regard themselves in kind of Bertie Wooster, a gentleman, and, you know, we're regarded around the world as being incredibly polite. Well, try telling that to cities around the world where football hooligans have come in, usually British football hooligans. I mean, they've spread that seed of, you know, thuggish violence around the world, and people will laugh at it. And I think Canadians have a self-denial about being very polite and passive and all those kind of things. Well, sure, that lasts until you see us play hockey. I mean, there's no other professional sport in the world where they stop the game, the referees push everyone back, and two of the players go around and punch each other's lights out.
Yeah, there's a joke about it, you know. I'm sure you've heard it. Yeah, and the joke is like this. I went to a fight last night, and a hockey game broke out in the middle of it.
And I remember going to the Leafs, Toronto Maple Leafs are the New York Yankees, Manchester United, Paris Saint-Germain of Canadian sport, and specifically English Canada. We can get into the whole sociology and anthropology of them. But anyway, I remember the puck goes into the corner of the rink and the two guys come in and they body check each other. And there's a bit of cross-checking, which is where one of the guys takes the stick to the other guy's head. And this roar, this psychic roar from the dark soul of Canada comes from the crowd of great violence. And to return to Justin Trudeau, I think he and his advisors knew that very well.
Mm-hmm.
At some point they said, look, you know, you can't go help people on the streets of Calcutta. You can't do, you know, walk or ski to the Antarctic. You've got to go and beat somebody up before you'll be taken seriously. And I regard Justin Trudeau, the politician, with the kind of caution and skepticism that a journalist should do. But as a man, I have tremendous respect for him. A couple of years ago, he and I actually got together. I was working for Canada's national newspaper at the time, the Toronto Star, and said, Justin, it's 5 years since we fought that night. Why don't you and I get into the ring, have a couple of rounds of sparring, and then I'll do an interview. And I think it speaks very, very well for Justin that he did. He said, great, let's do it. And we went to Montreal North. We went to his gym. He had just done budget, putting the nation's budget together. He was off to Europe the next day, and we had a couple of good, hard rounds of sparring. And then just stood in the ring as two men, journalist and politician, and conducted an interview. And I think it speaks well for the man as a person. Again, as a politician, I have tremendous skepticism, particularly after this recent scandal about the politics. But fair play to the guy.
Yeah. Let's deal with the... You're rather well known for having made it to the top despite having no steady job. You know, like most people in the creative industry, you've kind of gone from job to job and contract to contract and publication to publication. And this normally breaks most people. And yet you seem to have flourished under that kind of it's a very perilous way to earn a living.
I think I was very fortunate. While I was doing my doctoral research at the University of Oxford, I traveled to Malaysia and Singapore to investigate the demise of their football league, their soccer league, 10 years before, and I thought I was going to do historical archival research. What actually ended up happening was I discovered that match fixing was alive and well. It was spread across the continent, and a group of match fixers actually effectively adopted me and brought me into their gang.
Wow.
And there was a tense night it was about midnight. I was brought into a room in a golf course, a private golf course in northern Singapore, and sat down with a couple of these organized crime mobsters. And he had four or five telephones in front of him and beautiful woman on the bed, fully clothed, kind of lying there on the bed, ignoring us and a couple of Gundas. And he was fixing a Bundesliga game. That's a Premier League in Germany match. He gave me the result of the game before the game had taken place.
Wow.
And he was calling up people and talking to various people and really prominent coaches and players and football officials across Asia. And I watched this for an hour, and as we were talking and stuff. And finally, I asked him, what's the biggest match you've ever fixed? And he looked at me and shrugged and said, I don't know, what's bigger, the Olympics or the World Cup?
Declan.
And I had two thoughts in my mind. One is, please excuse me, listeners, I hope this doesn't offend you, but am I dealing with the biggest bullshitter in Asia? Is this just nonsense? And two, if I am not, how do I investigate this? So I was extremely polite. It's one of those things that always makes me laugh when you see Breaking Bad or, you know, one of these Hollywood adaptations of a mob story, a mafia story. And you see people being disrespectful to organized crime figures. You are never disrespectful to them, because if they allow you to be disrespectful, it attacks their very power and their very, you know, their street cred, and so they do not allow you to be disrespectful, nor do you have any desire to be disrespectful. But it was late, it was almost 1:15 in the morning, and I said, look, I'm so sorry. I know that you can fix many things here in Asia. I'm convinced you can do this. But I'm so sorry, sir. I just can't believe that you can fix a World Cup match. And there was a silence, and he kind of leaned back. And
that's not disrespectful. If someone had told me I just lied to them, I would find that, no matter how nicely it's phrased, that's dangerous ground you're walking on.
Well, fortunately, he didn't see that way. He just smiled, leaned back and smiled and said, okay, watch me.
Wow.
And so for the next few months, I watched them as they fixed a couple of games at the World Cup. And was in contact and have remained in contact with many active or retired match fixers. Now, if you follow football, if you follow sports, you're probably thinking at this point in the podcast, as I was in that golf course, private golf course in Singapore, this can't be true. I mean, you know, the World Cup, it's the biggest single sporting event in the world. It, you know, entire continents, cities shut down. It's followed by billions of people. What I did not fully appreciate at that time was that on some teams, you know, there are 32 teams that go to the World Cup tournament, and on about four or five of them, the players are ripped off and receive no money for playing in the biggest sporting tournament in the world. They're mostly from sub-Saharan Africa, and the larceny is extraordinary, and that is the reason why there have been player strikes. We're talking in September 2019. In June and July of 2019 was the African Nations Cup, and there was at least four player strikes at the biggest football tournament in the continent of Africa. And it was so bad, the maltreatment of the players was so bad, that Zimbabwe, which has a long and storied history of match fixing, the match fixers essentially ran the National Football Association. I'm not saying that either the players or the officials were involved in fixing this tournament, but the officials treated the players so badly that they didn't pay for their return air flight. they just skipped town and they didn't pay. And so the poor old footballers are stuck in Cairo, the other end of a very, very large continent, and they had to put together money to get each other back to their home country. That's not unusual in African football. The fixers knew that, know that. They spend months, if not years, establishing relationships with these guys. And they say, look, you're probably going to lose against Brazil or Germany or one of these big teams anyway. Why don't you lose with money in your pocket?
Yes. Yes, I have some sympathy, I have to say. It's very hard to point the finger and be on too much of your own high horse under those circumstances.
Well, particularly when FIFA, to be fair to FIFA, does pay each of the national football associations about $9 million to make sure that the logistics, the hotel, the food, the training camps, and the players are paid properly. In 2010, the Nigerians, who've had a long checkered history of corruption in virtually every level of their national sport.
Yes, they send me emails regularly.
There are many decent and good Nigerian football players and coaches who labor under this enormous weight of corruption. But normally when in World Cups, the teams arrive with roughly 15, 20 chef, massages, physiotherapists, coaches, goalkeeping coaches, whatever, a trained cohort of people to help their boys and women now get through and possibly win the World Cup. The Nigerian showed up in South Africa 2010 with 151 hangers-on. In fact, there were so many hangers-on that they kicked the players out of the hotel, the five-star hotel. They and their girlfriends, mistresses, wives, best friends stayed in the fancy five-star hotel. And the players who were there, who had got their country to the World Cup, were playing some of the biggest matches in the world, were stuck in a much cheaper hotel. I think it was a three-star hotel on the side of a highway. You know, just that basic endemic corruption allows the match fixers to flourish at the very highest level. So I'm not in any way saying that all 64 matches in the World Cup are fixed. I'm not saying that there was something dodgy going on in between France and Croatia at the great final in Moscow, but I am saying that we have not had a football World Cup of any level, under 17, under 20, Women's World Cup, Olympic football tournament, or the World Cup itself since the early 90s, where there hasn't been at least one game that's been fixed.
Well, that's an extraordinary statement.
It's backed up. I just wanted to say, because there's still possibly listeners with some skepticism, go back and looking on YouTube, punch in some of the sub-Saharan African teams, the highlights of the game, particularly from the 1990s. Into the early 2000s, up until current day. It's extraordinary. Go look at the final 10 minutes of the Japan-Poland game in the 2018 World Cup in Russia. It's absolutely clear that there's a fix going on. Every fan, or almost every fan in the stadium, is booing because the fix is so obvious between the Japanese and Polish team. So it really is undeniable. I did a series for the New York Times in 2014 where we showed that the fixers were operating in South Africa, fixing matches just before the start of the World Cup with the aid and assistance of officials at the South Africa Football Association. So the very organization that was putting on the World Cup had mysteriously run out of money a couple of months before the biggest tournament in their country's history is taking place. And somebody in that organization was helping the fixers.
Mm-hmm. So here's the obvious question, Declan, and you may not have an answer. What can be done? What then must we do?
Oh gosh, 90% of match fixing is preventable 90% of the time. And you were kind enough to talk about my nomadic lifestyle. Since my books have come out, the first one, The Fix, is in 21 languages. The Insider's Guide to Match Fixing is in 4. They've been optioned both in fiction and nonfiction in Hollywood. They've had a tremendous impact. And I travel around the world saying, look, we can stop this. We can stop this new form of globalized match fixing linked to sports gambling. And one of the first things we do is just pay the players.
Yes.
I mean, look, this is the world's biggest football tournament. Just pay the players directly. So yes. That if you're a corrupt official from Africa, yes, you can take a little bit of the money, but the players get paid, and it would stop match fixing at the Olympics, at these big international football tournaments like that. It doesn't have to be much more complicated than that. In Italy, Portugal, Spain, Turkey, Greece, Cyprus, where there's violence linked to what's known as il sistema, the system, where team owners sell points. They get to a certain threshold point in the season, and they just buy and sell points from the teams who are they going to be relegated or trying to win the championship. This has gone on for decades, almost a century. And the president, the former president of Italy, Monti, said, look, corruption in Italian football is so bad, we should just suspend the league for a year, clean it up properly, and then crack on. Unfortunately, they didn't do that, and Italy did not qualify for the last World Cup. Their standards are going down of playing. The league attendance is under real challenges because people, when they're putting their hard-earned money towards sport, they want the glorious uncertainty. They want it. They're not coming to see a theater. They're not coming to see plays with a scripted ending. They're coming to see the possibility of an underdog upsetting a massive overdog. There's all kinds of symbolism, as we were talking about earlier in the interview, connected with that, and they want it pure and clean and uncertain, and it's very, very easy to protect.
Well, that's very good to hear. That's quite reassuring, and I'm really glad that is the situation, and I'm glad that you're part of the force of making this a better world. You know, I think corruption breeds corruption. And the more corrupt we allow any aspect of our society, the more it spills over. It's almost contagious and kind of subverts other institutions and activities. So I'm all in favor of doing our, of just cleaning it all up. So what's next for you, Declan?
Well, right now I'm working on a book. The working title is Blood Sports. It's the connection between Russian organized crime, the Russian military intelligence complex, and international sports. So it's due out just before the Tokyo Olympics next year. It's another big one. The connections are extraordinary. And again, I don't think you can fully comprehend Russia without comprehending the effects of sport. So Russia has had at least two major land wars, one in against Georgia and the other one against the Crimea and the Ukraine. Both of those wars were launched during the Olympics. Mm-hmm. One was in 2008 on the opening day of the Beijing Olympics. The other one was during the 2014 Sochi Olympics. And that's not by accident. It's not some, you know, coincidence.
Yeah.
Sport plays an enormous, powerful role in that world. And much of it is controlled by organizations and institutions linked to the FSB, the modern-day KGB.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to that book. I'm sure it's going to be another bestseller for you. And hopefully it'll also be optioned by Hollywood for you, fingers crossed. And congratulations with your fantastic career. You're an inspiration, I'm sure, to many people about how they can achieve by doing,
look,
staying off the grid.
Thank you very much for those kind words. But really, to me, it's the work is everything. And as I think our listeners can hear, I'm pretty passionate about this. And I think it's an important thing to do. It's not something I might have seen myself doing a few years ago, but I've been given that this is my task to do, so I'm going to
go for it.
Bloody well do this best I can. So,
yeah, right.
Thanks
yeah.
very much for having me
no,
on.
It's
I really
been a
appreciate
it. Declan, start to finish, a pleasure. Claret and Conversation was brought to you by our sponsor, Clapham Publishing Services. It was executive produced, sound recorded, and edited by Teddy Ethoft. If you liked Claret and Conversation, please subscribe, share, and comment.